So this morning we got into the territory of expanding our hearts to extend goodwill to those we're having difficulty with. And it's a mouthful, those we're having difficulty with. Wouldn't it be just easier to say difficult person? It would be shorter, linguistically it'd be shorter, but it wouldn't quite be appropriate. It wouldn't be true because they're not a difficult person. As far as they're concerned, they're perfectly fine. They're doing the best they can. In fact, you are their difficult person. You change perspectives. And you know, they're, for this person whom you're having difficulty with, maybe you were really good friends at some point and they were your benefactor. Maybe they're your good friend and now it happens that you are entangled together in this situation. Actually, sometimes it's rather interesting because your benefactor and your good friend and your person you're having difficulty with could be the same person. You might have observed that different aspects of them. And in fact, you could be the person you're having difficulty with, your own benefactor and your own good friend. So there are different parts of us that could be our person we're having difficulty with. And it's also something I think really wise about not labeling them as a difficult person. There are people who care about this person and they think they're perfectly fine. But it's just this entanglement by labeling them as difficult. You get into a fixed view, of reality. And it's hard to get out of this fixed view of reality when you fixated it. Oh, I'm difficult. Oh, they're difficult. Oh, well, I'm having difficulty in these ways. Or we're having difficulty in these ways. That's how wisdom can come in. And also, when we talk about extending on our heart and goodwill, friendliness, in this category of difficulty, challenge, it's not about condoning harm that has been done. It's not about that at all. And it's not about forgetting or being really a wet noodle or like a doormat. It's not about that at all. We can continue to disagree with them, feel that their behavior, what they're doing or what they have done is wrong. But what this means, this practice means that we don't deny their humanity. We open our heart to their humanity. We don't dehumanize them. Oh, they're just bad. They're inhuman. They're awful. No, they're human. They're doing the best they can given their circumstances that they are in and all the causes and conditions of their life. In fact, as I mentioned the other day, the insight view that can come in is with all the causes and conditions, with the view of dependent origination karma, the law of karma, which you can't really understand historically, genetically, all the causes and conditions, family of origin, race, culture, political structures, genetics, years of evolution, just so many causes and conditions go into creating this person who is you, who is them. And if you were born as them with their genetic history, with their experiences, with their upbringing, with all of their life experiences, that's what you would do. You would behave that way. So again, it's not to condone the harm, but to have a different perspective, a wider, bigger perspective. So you can disagree, you can reprimand and take action, but not take that action out of hate, out of ill will, but out of love for yourself and also out of care for them. it's a different, it's so from the outside it might look the same, but from the inside it's a different way of taking action, different intention internally. There's a wonderful story also from Sharon Salzberg in her book Loving Kindness, and I'll read it actually. So she writes, during the time that I was living in India, I was practicing in Bodh Gaya, which is the town where the Buddha was enlightened, and I went with a friend to go to Calcutta. When we wanted to return to Bodh Gaya, there was a riot in the streets, and the only form of transportation available to take us to the train station was a rickshaw. Now, to most of India, rickshaws are little carriages pulled by men on bicycles, but in Calcutta they run. We go on a rickshaw, and the man started running down some back streets and alleys, and as we went through one, an extremely drunken man came out of the shadows and grabbed him. He made him stop, and then he started pulling me off the rickshaw. I looked around, and I didn't see what seemed to me a single friendly face. And I thought, this is it. I'm going to be beaten. I'm going to be raped. I'm going to get killed. And then my friend managed to shove the man away and get the rickshaw driver to start running again. We got to the train station, boarded a train, and returned to Bodh Gaya. But I was still very shaken. I went up to one of my teachers, Munindra, and I told him what had happened. And he said to me, oh, Sharon, with all the loving kindness in your heart, you should have taken your umbrella and hit that man over the head with it. There's that possibility too, she ends. So I love this story, and I love the instruction from Munindraji, who's this realized teacher. Like, you know, with all the loving kindness in your heart, you could have taken your umbrella and hit the man with it over the head, right? It's not out of will. It's out of love for yourself and for this man who's doing something really, really horrible. So that's the spirit. That is the spirit of developing loving kindness for people we're having difficulty with. It doesn't mean like, oh, you can do anything. No, you can't do this. You can't. And I still care for you. I care for your humanity. I see your humanity. You're a human being just like me. You're doing your best. And your best right now is really causing a lot of harm. And this can't happen. And also, when we get into the territory of working with the person we're having difficulty with, it is quite natural for anger to arise. And I wanted to bring some nuance also to the teachings on anger. One is that, you know, anger, when it actually arises in the moment as an emotion, you know, somebody does something, perhaps a moral transgression, and anger arises as the response. And that momentary anger actually can have a lot of information in it. Like, oh, it can tell us something wrong has happened. You know, sometimes, of course, anger could be out of our pride or our ego being hurt. I'll leave those aside. Hopefully we can see those more clearly with mindfulness and clarity. But anger in and of itself, it's not bad. It's not non-spiritual. You're not a bad yogi or a non-spiritual person if you feel anger. So what really can be helpful in this case is to really recognize the energy of anger, see it clearly. If action needs to be taken, so anger can motivate action. If action needs to be taken internally and externally, again, together with wisdom, not acting out of anger. That's, again, that's a very important. So it gets, see, these are all very nuanced teachings, right? Nuanced things to work with. So not acting out of it, but recognizing something, maybe there is a moral transgression, recognizing, taking a pause, okay, and using the energy of anger to act, not react out of it. And then it can be gone. It can be very clean. It can be clean anger, informing action, expression, and then letting go, gone. What is really corrosive, really, really corrosive, and the teachings on anger, that especially the ones that Bhante was talking about this morning, those are habitual, repetitive anger, which is corrosive. Somebody did something to you 10 years ago. You're still angry about it. It still comes up. Still going through it. Still going through it. Whew. It's not doing you any good. It's not doing anyone any good. And that person doesn't even know you're angry. Like, they're going about their life and doing their thing. You're not hurting them. In this case, anger is likened to a hot coal. You know, we're picking it up. We're picking up this hot coal, but to throw it as if we can even throw it at the other person. You know, they're far away. They're gone. And who gets hurt when we pick up hot coal? We get burned. The other person doesn't feel it, has moved on. So this repetitive, this chronic, this habitual anger is one that can be extremely corrosive and unhealthy, really unhealthy and unwholesome, akusala, for our own happiness, freedom. It's as if we're in a prison of this anger, because it's not promoting any right action in the world. It's just burning us up. It's just burning us up. In fact, it's holding us back. It's keeping us stuck from taking any wholesome action. So working with anger, again, takes a lot of nuance and mindfulness. What is it giving us information in real time? Is it corrosive? Is it habitual, etc.? So being in the territory of working with someone with whom we've had difficulty or we're having difficulty, and maybe anger, resentment, difficulty comes up, we also naturally get into the territory of forgiveness, the need, the heart's need for release from this habitual anger and difficulty. So I like to talk about forgiveness. So psychologists define forgiveness as a conscious, deliberate decision to release feelings of resentment or vengeance towards a person or group who has harmed you, regardless of whether they actually deserve your forgiveness. So that's that last part. That really is the most important part, really. Because we don't do forgiveness for anybody else's sake, whether or not they deserve it, whether or not they ask for it, they apologize. Forgiveness, the act of forgiveness, is really done for our own self, for the freedom of our own heart, so we don't keep burning. We don't keep burning in the fire. And again, I'll emphasize that with forgiveness, It's not that we gloss over or deny the seriousness of the offense against us. That's not the idea here. It's not about forgetting. It's not about condoning. And it's not about excusing any of the offenses that have happened. And also, we are not obligated to reconcile at all. There is no obligation with forgiveness if one chooses to forgive, as much as one chooses to forgive. There is no obligation to reconcile, to have a conversation, or meet them, or even release them from legal accountability. It's all very different. Instead, forgiveness brings the forgiver peace of mind and frees them from corrosive anger. Simply that. It's the freedom of your own heart, whether or not they deserve it, because you don't want to hurt anymore. You don't want to be in the prison anymore. You don't want to go over the resentment anymore, over and over and over, the corrosiveness, the pain of it, living it over and over again. Whew. Every time your mind goes into that. So in this way, forgiveness empowers you to recognize the pain that you've suffered without letting the pain define you. It doesn't define you anymore. It's an act of letting go of the pain, not letting yourself be defined by the pain. And it enables you to heal, for you to heal and move on with your life. Otherwise, you're stuck. You stay stuck. So really, forgiveness is for your own sake, not for anybody's sake. And again, forgiveness can only be private, only for your own benefit. Lack of forgiveness constricts us, make us less available in our life to take in the good, because we keep going over and over the way we've been harmed, the way we've been wrong, the way we're not even available. Our mind is not available to take in all the goodness that's available in our life, because we're stuck in this negative loop. Alice Miller says, genuine forgiveness does not deny anger, but faces it head on. There's a lot of wisdom in this. So forgiveness is not about pushing your anger away. Not at all. It means sitting with it. It can take a long process, and forgiveness takes a lot of time. It's not overnight. It takes a lot of time, and the first stages of it are anger, our resentment, just working through that until the time is ready and the heart becomes softer and softer with the intention towards the letting go, towards the forgiveness. So I'd like to share There are 12 principles about forgiveness from an article Jack Kornfield wrote, which I think is beautiful. I like to draw from that, so giving him credit. So the 12. So the first one. First is to understand what forgiveness is and what it's not. So as I've already mentioned, it's not condoning, it's not sentimental, and it's not about It's not for the other person. It's just for the freedom of your own heart. Number two is to sense the suffering in yourself, to really feel the suffering in yourself, to feel the suffering of holding on to the lack of forgiveness for yourself or another person, and to feel that it's not compassionate and it's not in your best interest. I mean, it's really not in your best interest. And when you see that, you can get the sense of the weight of not forgiving, the weight of hanging on to it, the weight that it has for you in your own heart. The third is, reflect on the benefits of metta, the benefits that actually a heart that is not in resentment, does not have ill will, but has a sense of goodwill. Now, we've talked about the various benefits of metta, both the 11 benefits from the suttas, as well as the benefits from, you know, the sciences discovering more and more. Of course, not to just do metta because of those benefits. That's not wholesome either, to become goal-oriented. Oh, I'm just doing this practice for those benefits, for my telomeres to get longer. Not wholesome. Not wholesome. But, hey, it's good to know. And, hey, while you're doing metta just for the sake of metta, these are spiritual goodies that will come along. It's kind of nice to know that, right? Four. Discover, I love this one, discover that it is not necessary to be loyal to your suffering. That's a good one. This is maybe my favorite. We are so loyal to our suffering that we focus on the trauma and the betrayal of what happened to me. So, yes, okay, it happened. It was horrible. But is that what defines you? Do you let that define you? Live in joy, says the Buddha. Not in the trauma. Not letting that define you. Jack points out, look at the Dalai Lama who bears the weight of the oppression of Tibet, the loss of his culture, and yet he's so very happy and joyful. The Dalai Lama says, quote, they have taken so much. They have destroyed temples, burned out texts, disrobed our monks and nuns, limited our culture and destroyed it in so many ways. Why should I also let them take my joy and peace of mind? That's profound. That's wisdom, right? When you see that, wow, that hits me. That really touches me. Whew. Why let them take everything? They've taken so much. Why let them take my peace and joy and peace of mind and freedom? Five, understand that forgiveness is a process. It happens little by little by little. Don't force it. You don't have to forgive. When you're ready, little by little. So it's not to be forced. Just when you're ready, when you feel ready, maybe a little bit. In fact, when you leave the hall, outside the hall, you will find a handout for forgiveness practice. Four sections. I'll talk about this now. Why not? Okay, we'll come back. So with forgiveness practice, I'll read the first part for you. In any way that I have harmed you, knowingly or unknowingly, by thought, word, or action, I ask for your forgiveness as much as possible in this moment. So every section ends with as much as possible in this moment. So with the four sections, the first one is offering forgiveness to actually in ways that you have harmed others, you're actually asking. So the first one is asking for their forgiveness. Again, in your heart. In your heart, you're asking them for forgiveness. And the second one, in the way that I have been harmed by you, knowingly or unknowingly, by thought, word, or action, I offer you forgiveness as much as possible in this moment. Again, I offer you forgiveness as much as is possible in my heart. Maybe very little is possible right now. Okay, it's this tiny bit of forgiveness I'm going to give you. The rest, I'm going to hang on to resentment. That's fine. Just whatever is available, don't push it. The third part, in any way that I have harmed myself, knowingly or unknowingly, by thought, word, or action, I offer myself forgiveness as much as is possible in this moment. So self-forgiveness, forgiving yourself, which is so important and often harder than forgiving others. And I'll talk more about self-forgiveness at the end of the talk. And this, and usually the three seem to be enough, but I like this last one, the fourth one, and this is from Larry Yang, to give him credit. And the fourth one is about forgiving circumstances, like forgiving the way things are, forgiving life. In any way that I have been unable to be with and respond skillfully to the pain and suffering of our world, my own pain and that of others, may I come to accept pain, suffering, confusion, and ignorance to be part of the journey, my own journey, and the journey of others. I offer forgiveness for the way that things are and have been, as much as is possible in this moment. I love the part, I offer forgiveness for the way things are and have been, as much as possible in this moment. Again, that brings in the view that we've talked about, the view of equanimity, of a bird's eye view of causes and conditions. So, the refrain, as you notice, is as much as is possible in this moment. As much as is possible in this moment. It's not to be forced. So coming back to this principle number 5, understanding that forgiveness is a process. And there's a story of a man who wrote to the IRS, I haven't been able to sleep knowing that I cheated on my taxes. Since I failed to fully disclose my earnings last year on my return, I've enclosed a bank check for $2,000. If I still can't sleep, I'll send in the rest. Number 6. It's a very important one. Very important one. Set your intention. Set your intention. And in Buddhist practice, intention is so important. If you haven't already heard so many talks and about intention, wise intentions, part of the Eightfold Path, blah, 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 this intention is so important. It's what your karma rests on. Intention, intention, intention. So both, it's because the reason why it's so powerful, the power of intention, setting your intention, both short-term and long-term. It, setting your intention is like setting the compass of your heart and your psyche. That's what it's like when you set an intention. You set your compass. And by having an intention, by setting an intention, you make obstacles that seem insurmountable. Not so, because you have that intention. You find creative ways for your true north. So setting an intention for forgiveness, when you realize, when you become really tuned with the cost of it, with how much the suffering is actually costing you, letting go, letting go. 7. Learning the inner and outer forms of forgiveness. So there are inner forms, your meditative process, the inner form of inner forgiveness, the release of your heart. And there are also perhaps external forms of forgiveness, making amends, having, if it's necessary for you to have a confession or have a conversation, maybe with a dear friend who holds you, may not necessarily be with the person, but that could be a part of it too, and the making amends too. So being open and creative to the internal and the external forms of forgiveness. Eight, start with whatever is easiest, the easiest way to open your heart to forgiveness. In the same way that we started metta with the easy person, where it's easy, we didn't start the first day with the person you're having difficulty with. We started with easy person and self, etc. Here also, start your forgiveness, train your forgiveness muscle where it's easy, where it's really easy. Maybe it's your easy person, maybe it's a child, maybe you forgive your dog, or maybe you forgive Dalai Lama. I don't know, wherever it's easiest. Really, it's easy for the heart to open to that forgiveness and then kind of work up. 9, be willing to grieve. Be willing to grieve. That's an important part of it. As Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, we really did so much work in grief. There's so many stages of grief. Anger, bargaining, fear, loss, sadness, just a lot of different parts to grieve, denial. So let yourself grieve. And you have to be willing to go through the process in an honorable way, as, for example, Nelson Mandela must have. He described it that before he could forgive his captors, he was outraged and angry and hurt and all the things that anyone would feel. So be willing to feel your pain. It's not about ignoring your anger or your pain. It's about being with it, facing it head on, opening to it and allowing it. Little by little, setting the intention, little by little. 10, forgiveness includes all the dimensions of your life. It's both work for the body, emotions, the mind. It could be interpersonal work through that, doing done through the relationship. So recognizing the multiple aspects of it. 11. This is another favorite of mine. Forgiveness involves a shift of identity. There is an undying capacity for love and freedom that is untouched by whatever happens to you. So this aspect is really recognizing, is bowing to, it's recognizing that capacity for love and freedom that's inherent in you. So trusting that and coming back to this through nature is the work of forgiveness. So this is pretty radical. It's really a different identity. It's not seeing your small self, this person who has been hurt and carrying this baggage of hurt, but it's seeing this expansive, this Buddha nature inside you that has the capacity for complete love and forgiveness, transcendent. So it's a shift in identity. It's the wisdom perspective that may not always be available. But that is really a teaching. Part of practice of forgiveness is actually part of this liberating, the liberation, the freedom that this practice brings about. 12th one, is that forgiveness involves perspective. You know, we are in the drama of our own life with our stories, with our with our stories, the drama, the little stories of our own life. And again, when we open up to the big perspective, and we see that it's not just our hurt, but the hurt of all of humanity. Everyone who loves is hurt in some way. Everyone who enters the marketplace of life gets betrayed. So the loss is not just your pain, it's the pain of being alive. And this helps you feel connected to the vastness of humanity, the common humanity of hurt. So what blocks, what are some things that block forgiveness? One is unreadiness, as already talked about. It's just a sense of unreadiness and this adage, this old adage of time heals all wounds. Maybe it needs time. Maybe it needs time when the time is ready. Another thing that can block forgiveness is self-protection. You feel like, oh, if I forgive this person, they're going to hurt me again. So I can't. And that can be resolved when the self-perception, when we perceive ourselves to be stronger in that relationship and our boundaries are stronger and we feel like, okay, I'm not going to be hurt again. So then the heart has the strength to forgive because it doesn't feel like it needs to armor itself and protect itself. Another is sometimes feeling like you need to save face in front of others. What people think of you. What? You forgave this person for what they did to you? And with some people, that's not, you know, forgiveness is not considered a virtue, right? So it could be an aspect of saving face in front of family or friends that you know, who don't see the value of forgiveness. Mahatma Gandhi says, the weak can never forgive. Forgiveness is the attribute of the strong. I'll read it again. The weak can never forgive. Forgiveness is the attribute of the strong. And I love this one from Lily Tomlin. Forgiveness means giving up all hope for a better past. And I'll read it one more time. Forgiveness means giving up all hope for a better past. So, I want to turn a bit, as I mentioned, to talk about self-forgiveness, which can be quite challenging, actually. Sometimes harder than forgiving others. Forgiving ourselves could be the hardest thing, the same way that self-compassion can be the hardest thing. And they're actually related. So, first, actually, I want to say a few things about self-compassion, because sometimes the reason why people don't engage in the practice of self-compassion, they feel that if you're compassionate to yourself, you're letting yourself off the hook. You get too soft. So it turns out not to be the case. And there are a couple of studies I want to share with you. I just saw these and I think they're quite interesting. So research actually supports a claim that self-compassion leads to taking more, not less, responsibility for our actions. It's kind of counterintuitive in a way, right? But see, this is how it works. So there's a recent study that was done at UC Berkeley by Brines and Chen, and they asked 100 undergraduate students to think about a recent moral transgression that they regretted and they felt guilty about. And then one group of participants was told to write something kind and understanding about what happened. Another group was told to think about your positive qualities. And another group was simply told to write about their favorite hobbies. Just write, something completely unrelated. And the group that was given the instruction to be self-compassionate, to write something kind and understanding about what happened that they feel guilty about, they were significantly more motivated to repair any harm that was caused by the transgression and committed to not repeat the mistake again than the other two groups. And it's especially interesting because one of the groups was thinking about their positive qualities, right? So the self-compassion, the kind perspective motivated them the most to take responsibility for the transgression. Another study by Leary and colleagues found that when participants were instructed to be self-compassionate when thinking about a past mistake, humiliation, or failure, they were more likely to accept personal responsibility for what happened rather than blaming things on outside people or events. And other studies have found that self-compassionate people are more likely to feel remorse and a desire to make amends, which is a good thing. Remorse is a healthy emotion, and also in Buddhism, remorse actually, when somebody has a sense of remorse for what has happened, it's a wholesome feeling because that motivates you to not repeat that. However, so in this study, so the studies have found that self-compassionate people are more likely to have remorse than to feel shame. And shame is a negative evaluation of one's worth as a person. Like, I'm worthless, I can't do anything. So when people have a sense of shame, then they're actually less likely to apologize for mistakes and take personal responsibility. So self-compassion actually not only does it not let you doesn't let you off the hook, but actually makes you be more responsible for any offenses. Apologizing for mistakes, making amends, feeling remorse. So, in terms of self-forgiveness, a few offerings, a few thoughts. And one is cultivate self-compassion. Really, that's the first one, because that can support, it's the container. This container of self-compassion really allows you to see yourself more clearly. Because if you're self-judgmental, then it's too dangerous to see your own mistakes. It's too dangerous, right? If your ego feels so dangerous. But if there is a sense of kindness, I love you anyway. It's you know, there's a sense of care. And yes, I see. You're doing your best and you screwed up. Yep, you screwed up. So you can own up. That way you can own up. Really own up. Acknowledge your part, your culpability. So forgiving self does not mean condoning your own actions. It means acknowledging that what you have done wrong. So it's the same way with externally when you're forgiving others, you're not condoning. Internally also. And you're not letting go of remorse. You're letting go of shame, feeling unworthy or bad to the core. Like, I'm worthy, I can never do anything right. That's not helpful. But don't let yourself off the hook with remorse. What can it be helpful? How can I avoid this in the future? And how can I make amends? That's another one. That's a third one or fourth one. I've lost track now. Self-compassion, own up, don't let go of remorse, make amends. Fourth one. Make amends. How can you make amends in your own heart and in the external world? And if the person that you've harmed maybe is no longer in the circle of the people that you're interacting with, or maybe no longer living, how can you make amends in the world? How are the ways that you can do that? And also cultivate empathy for the person that you have hurt. Cultivate empathy. And how do you do that? Question mark. Metta. That's what we've been doing all these days. That's the way. Cultivating empathy for the victim, for the person you've hurt. So I like to end with a poem by Fred Lamotte. And the name of the poem is My Ancestry DNA Results Came In. Just as I suspected, my great-great-grandfather was a monarch butterfly. Much of who I am is still wriggling under a stone. I am part larva, but part hummingbird too. There is dinosaur tar in my bone marrow. My golden hair sprang out of a meadow in Palestine. Genghis Khan is my fourth cousin, but I didn't get his dimples. My loins are loaded with banyan seeds from Sri Lanka, but I descended from Ravana, not Ram. My uncle is a mastodon. There are traces of white people in my saliva. 3.7 billion years ago, I swirled in golden dust, dreaming of a planet overgrown with lingams and yonis. More recently, say 60,000 BC, I walked on hairy paws across a land bridge, joining Sweden to Botswana. I am the bastard of the sun and moon. I can no longer hide my heritage of raindrops and cougar scat. I am made of your grandmother's tears. You conquered rival tribesmen of your own color, chained them together, marched them naked to the coast, and sold them to colonials from Savannah. I was that brother you sold. I was the slave trader. I was the chain. Admitted, you have wings, vast and golden, like mine, like mine. You have sweat, black and salty, like mine, like mine. You have secrets silently singing in your blood, like mine, like mine. Don't pretend that Earth is not one family. Don't pretend we never hung from the same branch. Don't pretend we don't ripen on each other's breath. Don't pretend we didn't come here to forgive. Let's just sit together. May our hearts be free with forgiveness for ourselves and others as much as it is possible. Thank you for your kind attention.